On May 11th of this year, Minnesota State Senator Mark Urata, a Republican from Buffalo, introduced to the state Senate Senate Bill 2380. 4 days later, Minnesota State Representative Lauren Jennings, a DFLer from Harris, introduced to the state House of Representatives House Bill 2533, an exact copy of Senate Bill 2380. I know it doesn't sound alarming, but just bear with me. Within these bills are provisions that, if passed, would allow electrical utility Xcel Energy, formerly Northern States Power Company, or NSP, to store spent nuclear fuel rods, nuclear waste, in, quote, an amount sufficient to allow the Prairie Island and Monticello nuclear generating plants to continue operating until the end of their federal licenses, end quote. The Prairie Island nuclear plant's licenses last until 2013 for Reactor 1 and 2014 for its second. The Monticello Nuclear Electrical Generating Facility can operate under license until expiration in 2010. The previous quote isn't alarming without some context to place it in first. Nuclear power plants burn nuclear fuel rods in the process of creating electricity. After a period of time, these nuclear fuel rods become too depleted to efficiently produce energy. These spent fuel rods are removed from the reactor core and placed in what is called a spent nuclear fuel rod cooling pool. This cooling pool is necessary because the spent fuel rods are very high in temperature and they're highly radioactive. The cooling pool is filled with water, which shields the environment from radiation and helps to lower the temperature of the spent fuel rods. No problems yet, but the spent fuel rod cooling pool contains only so much space. Nuclear power plants not only require nuclear fuel to operate, but they require a place to put the spent nuclear fuel rods after they are burned. Many of the nuclear power plants in the United States were built with the understanding that a national nuclear waste repository would be constructed. This has not come to pass. Because of this, many of the spent fuel rod cooling pools at nuclear electrical generating facilities are far too small to permit the continued full power operation of the plants until the expiration of their licenses. Time can be bought by moving the spent fuel rods closer to one another in the pool, but the rods can only be moved so close together, and this only grants electrical utilities a finite amount of time until space runs out. This nuclear waste storage crunch began in the late 1980s and early 1990s, and is increasing as time passes. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission, or NRC, which licenses and regulates all of the commercial nuclear reactors in the United States, permitted a temporary solution to the storage dilemma by allowing the spent fuel rods to be moved from cooling pools to what is called dry casks. While dry casking was permitted as an option for energy utilities operating nuclear power plants, each dry cask storage site required approval by the NRC. Minnesota law required the then Northern States Power Company, or NSP, to also gain approval for the project from the state legislature. NSP required a dry cask storage site for its Prairie Island reactors to permit Prairie Island to operate at full power until the expiration of its license. The Prairie Island nuclear reactor is located near the Midwakaton Dakota Prairie Island Reservation and Red Wing, Minnesota, both of which are about 35 miles southeast of the Twin Cities, along the Mississippi River. The Monticello Nuclear Electrical Generating Facility, Minnesota's only other nuclear power plant, located near Monticello, Minnesota, lies about 40 miles northwest of the Twin Cities, about 20 miles southeast of St. Cloud, and along the Mississippi River. Monticello does not require a dry cask storage site because some of its nuclear fuel waste was previously shipped out, extending its cooling pool capacity enough to last the Monticello nuclear plant until its license expires in 2010. The Northern States Power Company was granted its request for a dry cask storage site during the 1994 state legislative session. House Representative Lauren Jennings of Harris, who is the main author of the current proposal before the State House of Representatives, was the chair of the conference committee charged with smoothing out differences between the House and Senate versions of the 1994 bill approving dry cask storage at Prairie Island. Then-Governor Arne Carlson refrained from vetoing the bill granting dry cask storage. The legislative decision in question granted NSP the right to fill 17 storage casks with spent nuclear fuel. The agreement also allowed NSP to construct the dry cask storage site adjacent to its Prairie Island reactors and the Mississippi River. The approved dry cask site at Prairie Island has allowed the adjacent dual reactors to operate at full power through to the present. Northern States Power Company initially thought the dry cask program would only allow the reactors to operate until 2004, but a revamped storage plan extended that estimate until 2007. The revised time estimate was announced in late 1997, and at the same time, NSP asserted that it would halt its casking program at 17 dry casks. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission examines the safety and feasibility of continued nuclear plant operation when considering the renewal of nuclear power plant licenses. A major component of the NRC's feasibility concerns is the ability for the electric utility which operates the nuclear plant to dispose of the nuclear waste generated during the operation of the plant. If the electrical utility does not have the capacity to manage its nuclear waste during the period of time a new license would last, then it is highly unlikely that the NRC would renew licensure for operation. Fast forward to the present. The bills before the Minnesota Legislature, Senate Bill 2380 and House Bill 2533, would approve the storage of nuclear waste in, quote, an amount sufficient to allow the Prairie Island and Monticello nuclear generating plants to continue operating until the end of their federal licenses, end quote. With the context we now have, it is easy to see that the amounts House Bill 2533 and Senate Bill 2380 speak of are potentially far higher than what one would assume at first glance of this issue. Recently, KVSC News had an opportunity to speak with George Crocker, the executive director of the North American Water Office. The North American Water Office also coordinates the Prairie Island Coalition, a citizens group which has fought against the dry casking of nuclear waste at Prairie Island.
I'd like to start off with a comment from one of the legislators, sponsoring the bill, removing dry cask storage limits. Representative Lauren Jennings of Harris, Minnesota, stated that, quote, clearly the landscape has changed. We are short of electricity. No one disputes that, end quote. And I'd like to ask, are we short of electricity, and do we need to rally around nuclear power to make up for this electricity shortfall?
Well, that's sort of the bottom line question, of course, and it's a complicated question, but at the heart of it, why how much energy and electricity we need depends on how we use it. And of course, we use it extraordinarily wastefully. In the United States and in Minnesota, when people have to conserve, they can. For example, in California, now that they're going through that crisis, why we find that May consumption this year was fully 10% less than it was last year. There are similar experiences in places like Brazil that are also going through a big problem because they're so dependent on hydropower and now they're having a drought. There is a need for more capacity. There is a need for more transmission capacity, not necessarily big high-voltage power lines, but there is a need for upgrading the infrastructure. And that's sort of the challenge that's before us right now, because we're in a situation now where there is a host of new modern technologies, distributed generation technologies that are very cost-effective, that are very competitive, very reliable. They're commercially available right now. They're ready to go. And the reason that we don't invest in all of these microturbines and fuel cells and photovoltaics and wind power and so forth to the cogeneration to the extent that we could is because if we do, why that capacity will compete with the infrastructure that's already in the ground, the central station facility that is owned and operated by a specific class of people who want to maintain society's dependence on that technology. That's where the nukes come in. Now, if we were to get serious about making a phase-out plan for these reactors before we're absolutely forced to do so because of component failure, why, there is no doubt that we could do so very cost-effectively and very quickly.
Do you feel that part of the reason why many people are not advocating microturbines, fuel cells, photovoltaics, biomass, things like that, are primarily because a large portion of the population honestly have no clue they exist?
Well, you know, that's true. I think a large portion of the population is essentially functionally illiterate in terms of environmental things in general and certainly in terms of things electric. I mean, how many people know the difference between something as simple as a kilowatt and a megawatt hour? If in the face of that lack of knowledge, of that ignorance, why the utility industry assumes an aura of authority that it certainly doesn't deserve, but it gets away with it because nobody knows any better. Now, the remarkable thing is that when communities and organizations realize that they are, in fact, being impacted, directly impacted by the designs of the electric utility industry, they inform themselves very, very quickly. They become very smart about all of these things that are associated with how we deliver electric utility services, and they respond accordingly, responsibly, with knowledge about what are other ways, what are the more responsible ways of providing ourselves with utility services. So that's a big problem. Education sort of is the key to everything, you might say. And we got to people have to start understanding that we all need to learn an awful lot more, in a hurry, about what our stake is in the decisions that determine how electric utility services will be delivered to us, and we need to figure out how to participate in making those decisions, and we need to figure out how we can use those decision-making opportunities to provide ourselves with the technologies that do the job we need, turn on the lights, keep the refrigerator running, and so forth, without literally eroding the ecological foundation in terms of clean air, clean water, healthy food that we all sort of take for granted.
So you would suggest basically people educating themselves to try to find sort of an electrical / ecological balance. Like, you get what you need, obviously, because you do need a refrigerator, but you're not basically polluting the rivers, spreading radioactive waste all over the place just so you can get your refrigerator and your air conditioner.
Yeah, you don't need to blow up uranium atoms in order to boil water.
Okay.
You don't even need to boil water in order to get electricity.
I'm going to switch topics a bit over towards dry casking, specifically at Prairie Island, on the new proposal before the state legislature. What are some of the dangers of dry cask storage that Xcel could run into?
Well, that's again a really good question. Right now, there's 10 or 11 of these casks that are sitting out on a concrete pad on Prairie Island. These are storage casks. They're casks that cannot be transported. They're not designed to transport waste. In order for the waste that's in those casks to ever leave Prairie Island, it must be removed from the casks that it's in now and put in some other container. That must happen within about 20 years. If it doesn't happen within about 20 years, why the casks that are there now must be resealed. And the reason that they must be resealed is that they're pressurized with helium in there. And the reason that the helium is in the casks, in addition to the fact that helium is an inert gas, it's a relatively good conductor of heat. And it conducts the heat from the waste assemblies, which are still upwards of 500 degrees Fahrenheit. So they're very, very hot thermally as well as radioactively. And that heat must be dissipated to the atmosphere. And if it's not, why the heat will build up inside the cask, and then the fuel assemblies will tend to warp and twist and degrade and drop their fuel pellets to the bottom of the cask, and that's not acceptable. So if you remember your periodic chart from high school chemistry, why helium is a very small atom, it's second to hydrogen, and helium tends to get out of things that it's put in, including storage casks. And so after about, they're guessing, a 20-year period, why it will be necessary to recharge that helium atmosphere inside the cask. So in other words, either the waste has to be unloaded and put in something else, or the casks have to be resealed after that storage period. And the problem is that we have very, very little experience anywhere on Earth on how to do that. And the protocol that we have in place now for doing that assumes that the unloading process of a cask will simply be the reverse of loading. And unfortunately, that's not true for a number of reasons, including the fact that waste in casks is not sitting in a passive system. It doesn't just sit there. There's degradation that happens. The modes of degradation are numerous and little understood. They include a phenomenon called liquid metal embrittlement, metal creep. There is the constant neutron bombardment that is going on because it's in helium. Helium tends to penetrate into microscopic cracks in the metal, so there's that helium penetration at the granular level. There's even some microbial activity that can happen in that kind of an atmosphere. The long and the short of it is that after that 20-year period, when you put the waste back into the pool, and you'll have to put it back in the pool because it'd still be very hot thermally as well as radioactively even after 20 years, so it has to go back into the pool. And when you do that, you're putting hot metal into cool water. Now, some of you may be familiar with what thermal shock means. It's sort of like if you have a hot chimney on a kerosene lamp and you sprinkle water on it, the chimney will fracture. That's thermal shock. Now, I have a letter from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission that says it's extremely unlikely that the thermal shock, when you reintroduce the fuel, the spent fuel into the pool, that the thermal shock will cause the fuel assemblies to disintegrate in a pattern that goes critical. In other words, they don't know. We don't know what will happen each and every time we attempt to manage the waste that's in casks after a storage period, because we don't know how the waste in that particular cask has degraded over time, bearing also in mind that there can be flaws and fractures on the waste assemblies even before they go in that are undetected at the time of initiation of cask storage. So there's those kinds of problems that are associated with dry cask operations. And we're sort of ticking on the 20-year period now when we'll have to start to undergo that kind of experimentation. And unfortunately, we're all sort of in the zone of potential impact if things, if in fact the unloading procedure is not just the same as loading.
I would like to ask what you feel, what's the best scenario for the dry cask program, and is this just being said for the sake of optimism, and do you think it's actually realistic? Because I've read documents from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission that states they feel the dry cask program is actually safer than the cooling pool because you don't have to monitor it. And there's less of a chance of something going wrong, much like in Monticello in 1971 when the pool overflowed and they had to dump 50,000 gallons into the Mississippi of highly radioactive water and eventually got into the St. Paul municipal water system, I believe. But, I mean, the estimates from the not only the federal nuclear regulators, but the nuclear industry itself, I mean, is there sort of assurance of safety even realistic sort of estimates of what will occur?
Well, it all depends. One of the problems, if we move into casking operations extensively as the nuclear industry wants to do, is there's a tremendous problem with quality assurance, quality control in terms of cask fabrication. These pieces of equipment are very precise. They have to be designed and fabricated very much according to spec. Otherwise, there will be excessive radiation that gets out. The neutron shields will not be in place to protect the way that they're designed to protect. We don't have good assurance on quality control at this point in time. The industry is quite overwhelmed in terms of how it can manage the fabrication of the literally thousands of casks within a very short period of time that the industry thinks it wants. So there's those kinds of problems. Beyond that, again, you know, what do you do at the end of the storage period? And then ultimately, you know, these are storage casks for on-site. They're not designed for anything else. And nobody really knows what to do with the waste that we already have. If your listeners own homes, go take out your homeowner's insurance policy and look at the fine print towards the bottom, and there'll be a little disclaimer on there that says not liable for any nuclear event. If the nuclear industry had to actually pay for its own liability, pay its own freight, you know, this is a mature industry that's been around for 30 years now. If this mature industry actually had to pay its own freight, they wouldn't do it, because a single event could not only wipe out their entire business, but their entire service territory, amounting to hundreds of billions of dollars of damage, and they know that, and in order to protect the corporate entity from that liability, they have to have this Price-Anderson Act. So that in and of itself makes this whole debate, in my mind, absolutely ridiculous. If the industry is serious about providing us with utility services with nuclear power, it seems to me that they ought to assume the liability associated with their business. And if they can't, it ought to be the end of the discussion.
I'm going to go to the bill before the state Senate. If it passes the state legislature, do you think that the federal government would be like, no, you cannot operate this plant, even if they had the approval from the state government to continue storing waste at Prairie Island and possibly Monticello?
Well, actually, it would cut the other way. The federal government, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, will let them operate those plants even if the state doesn't authorize more waste, if the power company can find something to do with it. The constraint right now at Prairie Island is the waste issue. But the licenses will expire in 2013, 2014 from the NRC. The NRC's business is to ensure that continued commercial nuclear operations happen. And so they will be more than happy to relicense facilities that come up for relicensing, as they've already demonstrated on a number of occasions. So clearly, it's up to the people of Minnesota to decide what kind of energy future they want. There's another opportunity to really make a big difference in what that future will be as we again visit this nuclear waste storage issue. There's no doubt, as you're suggesting, that if Minnesota authorizes more waste storage, we will have continued nuclear operations until some reactor blows up someplace because of failed components or operator error, or until people realize that the ongoing degradation associated with that kind of technology is no longer acceptable.
Okay. One thing I'd like to ask is, many cite the expense of renewable energy sources is the reason why we can't replace the nuclear plants with something more environmentally benign. This may have been true 20 or 30 years ago, but is this rationale of, well, renewables are nice, but they're too expensive to put online and use to actually produce electricity, justified or even valid today?
Well, I think we could all agree that anything is cheap if you don't pay for it, right?
Yeah.
Now, the fact of the matter is that when we're talking about coal or high-head hydro or nuclear power, we only pay a small fraction of its actual cost. In other words, the price that consumers see is not reflected in their bill. Anything is cheap if you don't pay for it. If we actually had to pay the cost of liability for nukes, of waste disposal for nukes, of the mercury in the fish and the global warming from the coal and the destruction of the boreal forest and the inhabitants and people who lived there for the high-head hydro, if we actually had to pay those costs, we couldn't afford it, right? So we figure out how we can externalize those costs and pass them on to other people in other times. That said, why it's also true that the conventional technologies, the central station technologies, are technologies that are constructed on site, and the costs of doing so continue to rise dramatically, not even counting the cost of the environmental destruction that results from constructing and using those technologies. Compare that with the cost of the modern technologies, not the obsolete central station technologies of the last century, but the modern distributed generation capacity that comes out of factories. Well, we know that when you have more widgets coming out of a factory, the price per widget goes down. It's those economies of scale that are now kicking in. It's being driven dramatically by the events of California, which is one of the silver linings in the terribly difficult times that they have set themselves up for. But the costs of providing ourselves with renewable energy right now are very competitive. For example, in my home, I'm standing in my home right now. I'm looking out of a window at my 10 solar panels, photovoltaic solar panels, each one which produces 120 watts of power. This power goes into my batteries, and I use it through the house from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Right now, as I'm talking to you, I am not on the grid. I am using no power from the central station apparatus. All of the power that I'm using comes from my PV system through my batteries to the point of use in the house. I spent quite a bit of money on doing this, but it turns out that the payback period that I have, being as I'm off peak, I'm not off grid, but I'm off peak, allows me to not use power during the day, so I'm not stressing the utility system. I'm actually subsidizing the utility system with this technology. And then at nighttime, when there's power to spare in the system, why, I go back on grid and I buy power for about 3¼ cents from the power company, recharge the batteries if they need recharging, and then I'm ready to go again the next day. The payback period for this is less than the 40-year period that we typically amortize the Prairie Islands and the Shercos and the Monticellos and the L&S King plants. So the point here is that renewable energy technologies are very cost-effective right now if we apply them smartly and if we get to the point of bringing the Public Utilities Commission, and there's every indication that they're willing to go there to get into what we call time-of-day rates or real-time rates so that consumers have a much more clear picture of what is the actual cost of their energy habit on the system, and they're paying the actual cost rather than just assuming that electricity will be out of a socket in the wall whenever you want it. We'll have a little better ability to make consumer choices that are actually smart choices based on market forces. So the long and the short of it is that the modern technologies are available now. They're ready to go now. If we were to make the societal commitment to do them now, why, we'd stabilize rates, we'd stabilize environmental trends that are now going the wrong way. We'd stabilize a whole lot of social inequity that we back out of, because we wouldn't be abusing people for new power lines or nuclear waste dumps or things of that sort or the consequences of global warming. So there's every reason to make this energy transition. The bill that Lauren Jennings introduced takes us the wrong way.
As of the 12th of June, 2001, State Senate Bill 2380 and State House of Representatives Bill 2533 are still in committee. To find out who your legislators are, or to contact them, call 651-296-6013 or log on to www.leg.state.mn.us. Reporting for KVSC News, I'm Jed Cousin.